Going Linux, episode 114, setting up the remote desktop. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom.
Whether you are new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you'll find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
So, Tom, anything new in your world?
Let's see. A listener, now this is not a listener feedback episode, but a listener did write in with a drive question, and you answered that he should not be using FAT32 on a multi-gigabyte drive. Well, I went and checked it out, and my external 500 gig USB drive was FAT32.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of it was already used.
Right.
So, and I didn't have room anywhere else to put those files. However, it was less than half used. So what I did was, I used the disk partitioner and resized the partition down to the actual size of what was on there.
Right.
Then made a new ext4 partition, moved all the files from the FAT32 to the EXT4, deleted the FAT32, and resized.
Right.
Yeah. So that all took a couple of days, actually, to poking around at it now and then.
I can imagine, you know, doing it for the first time that it would take you a couple of days.
Well, being a USB drive.
Yeah, USB is slower, and dealing with a partition that is full is, of course,
right,
more difficult than dealing with one that's like 20% full.
Sure.
And you're just moving a few files around. But yeah, just for our listeners, kind of as a review, the reason that I recommended something other than FAT32, or worse, FAT16, is that there's a file size limit on FAT32 formatted partitions. And although FAT32 makes it compatible with Windows, Linux, and Mac so that you can read the files on any of those, the FAT32 file system allows you only to store files that are, I think it's 2 gigabytes or less.
Yeah.
So if you have a very large file, and typically where I have large files is where I have a VM image that may be multi-gigabytes in size. So my Fedora image on VirtualBox is, I think it's something like 20 gigabytes. I've given it as a limit. It's not occupying that space yet, but
sure,
it is definitely over 2 gigabytes. And if I try to move that over to a storage drive that is FAT32, it won't go. It just tells me it can't store the file because it's too big. So using ext4, which is the Linux file format that I use as well, ext3 or ext2 will do it just fine as well.
Yeah.
It'll hold the multi-gigabyte file and store it there. And I think you can get some software, if you do have a Windows computer, I think you can get an add-on for Windows that gives it the ability to read those partitions as well that are formatted with a Linux file system.
Sure. Okay. Well, now we've said the W word like 3 or 4 times, and that's quite enough.
Mm. Yeah, okay. Well, let's not mention that for the rest
okay.
of the
good
show.
Idea.
We'll use W instead of window. Yeah, W. Okay. I did indeed. And that was at your suggestion, and it was actually prompted by the fact that Google made voice part of Gmail.
They opened it.
Yeah, they opened it up, and I decided, okay, well, let's give it a try. So we're using Google Voice on both ends of this connection to record this episode of the podcast. So if it sounds to everyone, you know that it's Google's fault. But I have a suspicion that this is going to work just fine.
I think so, too.
And now that we have a Google Voice number, you will find it on our homepage. It is in the upper right corner, and it's got a big voice bubble up there saying, call me. And of course, you're leaving us a voicemail at that. And you can click right on there from your computer, and
it will connect you using it.
Yeah, it'll do whatever Google Voice does. And if you have Google Chat enabled and voice chat enabled, it'll just use Google from your phone. Or if you have other SIP clients set up, I'm assuming it'll work just fine. But if you're just dialing us from your cell phone or from a regular landline phone, or if you're calling us from outside of the US or Canada, which this Google Chat thing, voice chat and video chat, is only available from within Canada and the US at this point. Our actual phone number is 1-904-4-OUR-TUX. So that's the number 4 and then OURTUX.
Which is 468-7889.
That's right.
If you don't want to hunt for the little letters.
Yeah. I hate dialing with letters as well, but it's a great way to remember the phone number at least.
So let's stress test that right now. Everybody okay. Call 904-468-7889 right now. Here you go. 1-904-4-OUR-TUX. There you go, Larry. Yes.
Leave us a voicemail.
Larry's going to be picking up the voicemail, so I don't have to worry about it. I just overload
him. I'm going to have them forwarded to your email.
Oh, good. Okay.
All right. So our topic today is about setting up the remote desktop. We've had a little trepidation about this particular episode, haven't we?
We still have some trepidation, but we're going to go for it.
Yeah, we're going to try it live on the air for the first time. So live from our perspective, it'll be recorded from yours because, of course, you're listening to a podcast. So remote desktop. Let's get started with this somehow.
So, Larry, how do you do this? How do you set this up?
Yeah, good point. Now, we found lots and lots of articles on the internet and in various places that we go to find our ideas. I mean, to go and find.
Yeah, to steal our material from.
Yeah, all of that. And there's a particularly good one on how to forge. We'll include a link in the show notes on how to set this up. But there's not really a lot of good resources there about how to actually use it once you have it set up. So we're going to include those instructions on our website as well as a link to the how to forge article. But for now, let's actually walk through the how to forge article. And Tom, perhaps since you've had a little trouble following this and understanding what it is we're doing here, this would be a good experiment for us to do live.
Yeah, let's do that.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so big picture here. What we're trying to do is use the Linux tools that come with your Linux distribution to allow one Linux user to connect to the screen of another Linux user to see that screen and possibly even to control that screen remotely. Now, Linux provides you with some tools to do that from within your own network. And if this actually works out, we are going to be doing this across the country. Hopefully this works out. We're going to be doing this across the country where Tom's going to see my screen and I'm going to see his, even though I've got a router that acts as a firewall and Tom doesn't.
Actually, I do now.
We should be able to bypass all that. Oh, you do now?
Yeah.
Oh. So.
And that's another part of the challenge.
That's another part of the challenge. Okay, so we'll get into port forwarding. I set up port forwarding on my router already, but we may have to do that on yours for me to see your desktop as well. Okay, so starting with the How to Forge article, which is authored by Falco Timme, And this is one from 2008. So the screenshots are not the current release of the Linux distribution that he's chosen here, which is Ubuntu, but they still apply, even though he's using 7.10 and I'm currently on 10.04. The menu selections and everything are the same. So hopefully this remains the same for the future or something similar. And I tried it as well on Fedora, and it's exactly the same setup. So
okay.
I think we should be good from distribution to distribution. So the first thing you want to do is enable someone to be able to connect to your Linux desktop. And Linux has the tools available to both set up that connection as well as to make a connection to another computer. So if our listeners at home are following along and they happen to have two computers on the same network, then this will be very, very easy for them. What you do is you go to the system menu, and of course we're dealing from a GNOME perspective here, so mm-hmm. the menu selections are going to be a little different from KDE, but what you're looking for is the setup for remote desktop. Under GNOME, you go to System, Preferences, and then in the Preferences menu is Remote Desktop, so you go ahead and select that. So
I just did.
Do that on mine, so Preferences. Remote desktop. Okay. Now there are several checkboxes there. The one that you want to use to set up the sharing is called sharing. It's in the section called sharing. And make sure that allow others to view your desktop is checked. There's a little box below that that says allow others to control your desktop. So if you want somebody to actually control your desktop, you would select that. Let's for right now just uncheck that, because you and I, Tom, are both recording something while trying to do this, and we don't want to mess up the recording by clicking spuriously in the wrong place and turning off the recording accidentally. So you've got allow other users to view your desktop checked, and you've got allow other users to control your desktop.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, good. Yeah.
Okay.
I got it.
So now it's got a little piece of information below that that says your desktop is only reachable over the network. Over the local network. Others can access your computer using the IP address. And of course, it gives you your local IP address, which means that if you're connecting to a computer across your own local network, you're fine. You can use that IP address, or they also provide a yourcomputername.local as a link using the domain name and your computer name rather than the IP address. You can do it either way from the local network. Now, if you're trying, as Tom and I will be trying to do, connect across the internet, of course, your 192.168.whatever is probably not going to work. What you really need to do is go to whatismyip.com and find out what your external internet IP address is. Now, if you've got a firewall like both Tom and I do, you also, before you can connect across the internet, you need to set up port forwarding so that the remote desktop can make its connection across the internet. Now, I've already done that, Tom, so we'll cover how to do that a little bit later. Let's just complete our thought here on getting this thing set up.
All right.
So the next thing you need to do is you need to look at the section here called security. Now, the first checkbox here gives you a little added security if it's checked. And what the checkbox says is you must confirm each access to this machine. What that really translates to is when, Tom, you are trying to connect to my machine, if I have that checkbox checked, before you can make the connection, I have to click a confirmation button that appears in a dialog box. So it'll pop up something on the screen and say, Tom is trying to connect to your computer. Do you right. want him to do that? If it's unchecked, and I'm going to uncheck it, it will grant you access right away. Now, the next box down is once you have access, whether I've given you permission through that dialog box or whether I have unchecked that confirmation message, here it says require a user to enter this password. So if I check that checkbox, I can now enter an up to 8-character password into that dialog box. And that means that when you connect, you're required to give a password before it actually allows you to connect. So that's actually two separate levels of security there. One, the first one requires that a user confirm that someone can give access. And then the second one is a password.
That sounds like a great way to go.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to uncheck both of those?
I'm going to, for sake of our exercise here today, uncheck it so that now once you make the connection, it'll give you immediate access to view my desktop. Now, I haven't given you control of the desktop, so this is going to give you visibility.
All right.
Have you followed so far?
I'm following so far.
Okay. Now, if I were doing this for real, I would want to, at the very least, have a password. And where you might actually use this is if you have a remote computer that you want to log into and control. There are other ways to do this, of course, through SSH and various other things. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted to use remote desktop to do this, you could uncheck, confirm each access to this machine, but check the checkbox that requires a password, enter a password in there so that when you do connect across the internet, even you are required to put in your password. Of course, only you would know the password and anyone else attempting to have access to this without your permission would have to either figure out what your password is, so make it something complex, or they simply don't have access.
Have to go away, yeah. So what this is good for is, for instance, if you've gone over to Grandma's house and put Linux on her machine, and she calls you up and says, Jimmy, I can't figure out how to... I don't know why she'd call you Jimmy. So she calls you up and says, Jimmy, I can't find my email. Where do you find that? Well, you can jump right on the internet, take control of her machine. She can watch you do it. And showing somebody how to do something really makes it stick.
Yeah. So this, from a business perspective as well, is a way to get to give that support that you want folks to have, you know.
Sure.
If they have a Linux machine and you have a Linux machine or a Mac machine or a W machine, this all works. And we'll get into that in a few minutes as well.
Good. Well done.
Yeah.
Good job, Jimmy.
And the last checkbox under security is configure network automatically to accept connections. So essentially that just means, okay, no human intervention required. Let's go ahead and allow, once you've passed the password test and the confirmation test, let's just set it up so that it'll happen automatically. Which, of course, if you're supporting Grandma, you want that to happen. So I'm going to check that here as well, so that, Tom, when you connect to my machine, it will automatically accept a connection. It's not going to prompt me to accept it again. And so now, just to review, we have the sharing, the two checkboxes. The first one, allow others to view your desktop, checked. And for our purposes...
I'm not going to control your desktop, so we don't check that one.
Right. And then for security... I have unchecked must confirm each access to this machine. I have unchecked require password, and I have checked configure network automatically to accept connections. And there are three or so radio buttons under there as to whether or not you want to display an icon in the notification area. That's not necessary. I'll just leave that wherever the default is, and now we'll click close. All right. So now, Tom... All right. In order to connect to my machine, here's what you need to do. You need to go to the Applications menu. And then
probably Internet.
And Remote Desktop Viewer is what you want. So once you have that open, Tom, what you want to do is, since you're connecting to my computer and it's not on your network... With the remote desktop viewer open, you click the connect button. And that's in the upper left.
Just did it.
Okay. And now for host, you want to put in the IP address. So for those of you following along within your own network at home, it's the IP address that appeared in the remote desktop when you were setting it up for the other computer. And you can also use the computer name .local if you wish. So Tom, my IP address.
Okay, that's there. I have your IP address.
Right. What you don't want to do is click the find button. It's sitting there right next to where you typed it in. But what that would attempt to do is find that IP address on your local network. And of course, I'm not on your local network. So what you want to do is go down to where it says connect in the lower right-hand corner. And go ahead and click that connect button.
And full disclosure here, you may notice, good listeners, that the audio is a little bit different. Something strange just happened. Well, what happened was a complete meltdown during the recording of this episode because Larry had a little problem.
Just a little one. Unbeknownst to me, while Tom and I were using Google Talk to talk to one another and we were attempting to make a connection, him to me and me to him, using the remote desktop viewer. At exactly that same time, my wife decided to speak with her sister by video Skype call, and my poor Time Warner cheap little internet modem that they provide us couldn't handle the load, and everything crashed on my end. Took me a little while to figure out that it was the modem and not the wireless router, which had been giving me a little bit of trouble here and there. And finally, we got it all cleared up.
Right, but not in time. Our window of opportunity where we could both be available to record was gone. So now it's a week later, believe it or not.
Yes.
Seems like moments to you, but just enjoy the free time travel. So, Larry, I think where we were last time was we had gone into System Preferences, Remote Desktop, and we had set that up.
Yes, we had set it up, and we had gotten to the point of actually making a connection.
Right. You were giving me instructions, and I was about to connect to you.
And about the time you clicked the button to connect is when everything fell apart. So Tom and I were each able to connect to one another's computers, and in fact, all of the instructions we gave worked perfectly. With the possible exception for some of us that we need also to include some information about how to get around a firewall,
right.
In particular, a router that's acting as a firewall.
Yeah, if you've got a firewall, if you've got a router that's a firewall, none of this is going to work until you go in and unblock one of the ports. And I believe that port is 5900.
Yes, that's exactly the right port. And we will have some screenshots linked from our show notes that will give you a visual as to how to set up port forwarding on a Belkin router and on a Linksys router. Now,
right.
Each router may have a slightly different setup, which is okay, but I think between the two screenshots and the description that we have written out, you will find that you'll be able to figure it out for your particular router as well.
Unless...
Uh-oh.
Unless when you bought your router, you opened the box, pulled out the router, threw the instructions away, plugged it in, and it worked perfectly. Well, you need to have the IP address to go to in your browser to get to the setup of your router.
Yep.
So if you threw those instructions away, you're going to have to go online and find out what that IP address is that gives you control of your router. And probably change your password as long as you're in there.
At least change your password. If
right.
you set it up out of the box, I doubt there's even security on there.
Right. It's the username right now is admin, and the password is probably admin.
Yes, exactly. So we're not going to give you the step-by-step instructions on how to set up your particular router, because your router may vary.
If you go to the show notes for this show and look at the screenshots, yours is going to look something like ours do. You can see ours look real similar, even though they're completely different routers.
And what you're looking for is something that either mentions port forwarding, as it does on Tom's router, which is the Linksys router.
On mine, I have to go in through, I think it's called Applications and Gaming. I'm on the way there.
Or something that mentions virtual servers, which is what it shows on mine, the right. Belkin router. And mine gives you the ability to set a range of ports for the inbound port, which you set to 5900 through 5900. You only want that single port. And the output port, or the private port, as it's called, I also set to 5900. And, of course, it asks you what is the IP address of the specific machine on your network that you want to pass the traffic, that's the remote desktop traffic, on port 5900
right. to. So, the local, where are they going to get that local address, that 192 dot whatever?
If you're in GNOME, in the upper panel, if it's Ubuntu or Fedora or something like that, the upper panel, if it's Mint, it'll be on the lower panel. There will be an icon in the notification area that indicates what your network connection is, whether it's wired or wireless. There'll be a little icon there. If you right-click on that icon and select Connection Information, that will give you the IP address right on little panel that comes up. And I have both a wired and a wireless connection available to me. So if I select the wired connection, it shows me that I am on 192.168.2.5. And the wireless one shows me that I am connected on 192.168.2.3. Your specific IP address may be completely different. For most routers, it will start with 192.168.something. The Linksys routers may have .1.something. D-Link, I think, have .0.something. And the Belkin ones, since they OEM all their stuff, it varies from router to router. But yours may actually begin with the number 10 or 12 or some other number rather than the 192. It's really up to the router manufacturer as to what range they want to put their IP address in. So yours may be completely different from ours, but that's how you determine which IP address your internal machine is using on your internal network.
And that might have sounded very complicated and scary. It isn't. Go look at the screenshots and you'll see what we're talking about. You're going to need to fill in the last part of your local IP address, and you can get that from your little connection icon.
Yes. You said that so much more succinctly than I did.
Well, you were given a lot of information, good information there, Larry.
Okay, good. All right. So now that we know how to set up remote desktop connections so that we can allow access to our computers, and now that we also know how to make the connection so that we can connect to a remote computer, even around a firewall, there is one other piece of information. For those of you who are connecting to or through a corporate network, it's quite possible that your IT department, unless you are the IT department, that your IT department has blocked all traffic on port number 5900. In which case, they don't want you doing this. So I'm not going to tell you that you could change the port number and bypass all of that, because that would not be appropriate.
Right. The IT department might not like it, or the principal of your school might not like it.
Exactly. So I'm not going to tell you that you can do that or tell you how to do that, and we'll just leave it at that. How's that, Tom?
Just whisper it to me.
Okay.
If I did want to figure out how to do that myself, where would I start, Larry?
Google.
No, okay.
Well, essentially, I think if you looked at the forums for your particular distribution of Linux, you might find some instructions in there from someone who has done it. And as I alluded to in my non-description of how to do it, it's a matter of changing which ports Remote Desktop is using to find a port that's available, and then forwarding that port in your firewall, assuming that on the other end, the end that's giving you trouble, that particular port is open. And it's a bit of trial and error. And you don't want to choose something like port 80 because that's where all your internet traffic goes and you might be interfering with your ability to browse the internet. So you really shouldn't be doing this in a corporate network if they don't want you to do it. And, you know, they may be blocking port 5900 for some other reason. And you could ask your IT department, can you do this and which port should you use? But then you've alerted them to the fact that you're trying to do it, and they might not like that in the first place. So, no warranty implied.
So now I've been playing with this for about a week and run across some interesting stuff. I found out that when my host machine is Ubuntu 9.04 and my remote machine is 10.04, on the 10.04 machine, it asks for, do you want to use VNC or SSH? And I have to specify VNC. On the 9.04 machine, when I, for instance, if I try to connect to yours, it doesn't ask that. So I think it must be older software or something.
Yeah, I think that's what it is the older version of Remote Desktop didn't give you the SSH connection ability, and SSH uses a whole other port.
Yeah, we might talk about SSH later.
Right, exactly. And in fact, if you have a later version of the Remote Desktop client on your particular machine, you could use SSH instead of VNC protocol to get around that firewall issue, that corporate blocking issue, if they allow SSH connections. And SSH uses port 22. So if you are trying to connect using the SSH protocol, that's the port you'll need to forward, and that's the port that needs to be able to communicate from one end through the internet, through any firewalls, through any corporate security, through to the other computer on the other end.
Right. Okay, and then the next thing I discovered is I tried playing a movie, or actually playing a Hulu video on one computer and looking at it through the other computer, which was kind of cool, except on the other computer, of course, you don't get the audio portion of it, just the video. Mm-hmm. And I found out that when you make the connection, you have the option of using JPEG compression, and that makes the video a lot less jerky. It's still a little bit jerky, but it's watchable as a silent movie.
Mm-hmm. Using the JPEG compression, does that make the video a little more grainy or a little less detailed?
Well, JPEG is supposedly lossy, but I couldn't see any on my little netbook screen. I couldn't see a difference.
Okay.
And then one more thing, on the host machine, you do not want to be running CompiS if you're going to connect to it from a remote, and I'll tell you why. The picture comes up perfect. There's the screen. Yep, that looks just like what I see over there, but it's frozen. You're never going to see anything else no matter what happens over on that other machine. And the way I found this out was I thought I could connect to this machine here from a remote location and then open Cheese and look through my webcam and see what's going on in my house. Wouldn't that be cool?
That is cool.
Except all I could get was that one frozen frame, and it was ticking me off. So I thought, wait a minute, this was working before. Something's happened here. And what had happened was I had turned CompiS on. While you and I were recording, I had turned it off. I always turn it off just because it takes up too much machine cycles. And I like to run lean, mean, and clean when we record. Mm-hmm. So I had turned it off. And easy way, by the way, to turn CompiZ on and off is an application called CompiZ Switch, which is available in the repositories.
Right. CompiZ Switch, and the other one is CompiZ Fusion Icon is the name for an alternative one as well. And they both work essentially the same way. You click on it or right-click on it and turn CompiZ on and off. So, and we've talked about that in previous episodes.
Right.
So go back and listen if you need more information. All right, Tom, we have several links that we are going to be providing to other articles or webcasts or podcast episodes that discuss how to make the connection using some other software. There's one from a company called No Machine, and they make a software program called NX Free that's available for Linux. And I believe it's available cross-platform as well. We'll have a link to that. We'll also have a link to one of Nightwise's Nightcasts that describes how to make that connection and use Ubuntu as a terminal server. So within that particular episode, he talks about how to make the connection. And we'll also provide a link to an Ubuntu Geek article on how to use NeatX to make a connection remotely. And the description there is specifically for Ubuntu 10.04, but I'm sure it applies to other other distributions as well.
There is one more link there, and that is about doing a secure remote access.
Ah, yes. And this one talks about SSH. And I believe this one talks about how to do it at the command line as opposed to how to do it through remote desktop. But it also has a little description about NX Free at the bottom and some other links to other articles, other places. It's an article from 2007 in Linux.com. So it's a little dated, but it still applies.
And the reason you might want to think about SSH is because the way we've taught you so far, all anybody has to do is to guess an 8-character password.
Yes.
So that's not, you know, it's not wide open by any means. But if you're going to give someone else control of your desktop, or if you're going to want to take control of grandma's desktop, that might not be, well, see how well you sleep with it and decide for yourself if you want to leave it at that or go to SSH.
Right. So if you're good at creating very complex passwords, you're in, at least as far as 8 characters gets you.
But yeah, put some numbers and some punctuation and some caps in there.
Right. But if your password is password, expect that somebody will guess that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we've told them more than we know at this point.
You may be right. Okay. So do you have a software pick for our episode today, Tom?
Just remote desktop. I've been just delighted with this. Every now and then I go back and think of something else. Hey, you know what else I could do? except, you know, on the remote desktop, the remote machine would not show the panel at the bottom.
Huh.
For some reason, I don't know why. So I moved that panel to the top and everything's fine now. Just have to get used to having it on top.
I know when you have the screen for the remote machine on your screen, you can choose a selection in the remote desktop viewer that allows you to scale the screen size. So if you have two different resolutions, that might help you out a bit.
Oh, and I never clicked on that because I didn't know what it was. I'll do that so I can put my panel back on the bottom because it's driving me nuts up there.
Okay, yeah, that makes it a little more difficult to see because, you know, if you have smaller fonts and you're looking at a large remote screen on a small local screen, you may have some trouble seeing the actual text and so on. But if it's a screen you're familiar with, you probably know where things are anyway.
Sure. Cool. So my answer to your question is, no, I don't have a software pick. Larry, do you?
Yes, I do. Guess what I found this month?
Tell me all about it, Larry.
I found Audible's free audiobook player for my Android phone.
Oh, and that's Linux.
Yeah, exactly. And I downloaded it from the Android store. And the application actually allowed me to download and listen to any or all of the audiobooks that I have in my Audible library right there on the phone. It works great.
How's the audio quality on an Android phone?
Really, really good. I actually use my phone as my podcast player, as okay. my multimedia player, and the quality from the Audible player is on par with the quality that comes from the standard media player that's built in. And in fact, it once you show the widget for it on your screen on the Android phone, it's got little places for widgets for whatever you want. Uh-huh. It looks very similar to the media player. It is a different widget. But, you know, there's a play button and a skip to the next track button and that sort of stuff. And the audiobooks have really excellent quality.
And free. The application's free.
It is free. And when I went through the Audible store, one of the things I searched for was the word free, because I thought, well, okay, if this doesn't work, I don't want to pay for a book.
Sure.
So I searched for a book that was free, and I found one that not only was free of charge, but is about the concept free. It's a 7-hour book by Chris Anderson, who also wrote The Long Tail.
Right.
Which is a book about marketing to niche markets as opposed to the mass audience that most advertisers go after. And the title of the book that I downloaded is Free, The Future of a Radical Price, Unabridged. And it's narrated by Chris Anderson himself. It's a great book. I've only started listening to it, but yeah, like I said, the quality on the Android phone is excellent, and I really like it.
And this is Linux related here, because that Android phone is running Linux.
Yeah, that's right. And as you know, for months now, we've been asking our listeners to ask Audible for Linux support. Well, Google's Android phones are based on Linux. And if Audible has a player for Android, my question is, how far off can the Linux desktop player be?
Yeah, we got to be close.
Yeah. So it's really, I would think, just recompile the code and fix any bugs related to moving it from the Android platform over to the desktop platform, huh?
Yeah, you know what? I think Google's got a little more clout than we have.
Yeah, maybe so. But hey, our listeners can help, as we've been asking them to do. So if you're a Linux developer out there, especially if you work for Google, let's get in touch with Audible, and that you can reach them at greatideas@audible.com. And there you can offer to help them recompile that source code so that it runs on Red Hat or Mandriva or OpenSUSE or Ubuntu or Mint or any other desktop
right.
distribution of Linux. That would be great.
Let's get them off the dime here.
And in fact, Brian, one of our visually impaired listeners, provided us a link to a blog post that calls for readers to contact Audible and Google about making these products more accessible as well for the visually impaired. And we'll provide that link in the show notes. It's a blog post by Ted MC from blindmind.net from September 1st of 2010. Take a look at that, see what you think, and The blog post is entitled Audible Releases App for Android Mobile Phones, and what they're talking about is this Audible audiobook application that we've been talking about here. We'll include that link in the show notes, and the article is by Ted MC from blindmind.net, and in the article, he talks about the fact that both Google and the folks at Audible need to spend a little more time and attention to making their applications more accessible to the visually impaired.
As Larry said, the link's in our show notes. If you feel like it, take a look at the article. And if you are moved to do so, contact Audible and Google and let them know.
Since we're talking about Audible, this episode is sponsored by Audible. And if you listen to it, Audible has it with over 75,000 titles and virtually every genre of audiobook. You'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and a 14-day trial by signing up at www.audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. That's audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. And our next episode, Tom, will be the Computer America episode number 30, my 30th appearance on Computer America.
Woohoo!
Yeah, so until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information, detailed instructions, screencasts, and illustrations.
And you can email us with comments, questions, and suggestions. And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the Podcast Alley button to leave your topic suggestion while you vote for us on their site.
And you can also send us audio comments by email or voicemail. We'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com. Just record your audio and include it as an attachment. Or use our voicemail line, our brand new, spanking, shiny new voicemail line. +1-904-468-7889. And for those of you who like dialing letters instead of numbers, that's 1-904-4-OUR-TUX, the number 4, O-U-R-T-U-X, but I find it easier when dialing to use 904-468-7889.
And you can follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. We are Going Linux, all one word. And you can download episodes from the website, or you can use the Flash Player to play them right on the show notes page.
You can also get future episodes delivered directly to your computer automatically as soon as those new episodes are available. For instructions on how to subscribe to a podcast, to make that happen, go to subscribe.goinglinux.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.